Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. My guest today, neuroscientist Bruce Hood, says we are wired from birth to believe the unbelievable, the superstitious, the supernatural. He calls that readiness super sense. Love it or hate it, he says, it's part of who we are. It has its problems, it has its pluses. This hour on point, why we believe the unbelievable. You can join the conversation. Are you beyond superstition? Are you sure? Do you embrace the supernatural? Why? Joining me now in the studio is Bruce Hood. He's chair of the Cognitive Development Center in the Experimental Psychology Department at the University of Bristol. He's a neuroscientist focusing on child development. His new book out this week is Super Sense, Why We Believe in the Unbelievable. Bruce Hood, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Now, a lot of people these days say, I'm not superstitious. You say we're more superstitious than we know. What's your evidence?
Well, I think that when people say that they're not superstitious, they're usually referring to things like black cats and walking under ladders, all the sorts of rituals that are commonly recognized in society. But in the book, I draw people's attention to a whole variety of beliefs that that are not obviously superstitious or supernatural, but when you kind of look into the basis of these beliefs, they turn out to have the same sort of notions.
Not exactly rational either. Like what?
Well, the one I like the best is probably the most common one, which is that 9 out of 10 people think they can tell when they're being watched from behind, even though there's no way they could actually ever see the person. This was first reported 100 years ago, and it's great I'm here in Boston, because it was reported by one of the first professors of psychology at Harvard. Titchener asked his students, and 9 out of 10 said that they thought they could tell when they were being watched. And I repeated that 100 years later at the University of Bristol amongst my undergraduate population. These are students who have been taught about how vision works, how the light enters the eye, nothing exits the eye. And yet, when I asked them, do you think you can tell when you're being watched from behind, exactly 9 out of 10 said that they could do this as well. So this is really interesting. This is something which has obviously not changed in 100 years, despite what we now know about how vision works.
Of course, people knew quite a lot about vision, maybe not scientifically, but practically 100 years ago. Even now, and it's something interesting you point to here, that I can imagine people saying in response to the observation you've just made, well, that's not superstitious or supernatural. I really can tell when I'm being watched, and science just hasn't caught up with what I know. Now, is that super sense, or is super sense something else then? Are you talking about supernatural powers when you say super sense, or something else?
Tom, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is the point. When you take any of these beliefs and you test them under rigorous experimental scientific methodologies, they simply don't hold up. The evidence for the paranormal, the supernatural, is at best equivocal. Okay, you're always going to find somebody who has a report, and there's always a few papers, but the majority of conventional scientists have rejected these claims because they don't validate, they don't reliably replicate. And if you have a phenomenon that doesn't measure up and doesn't replicate, then you can't study it empirically, and so it doesn't achieve the level of what we call scientific evidence. And yet, and here's the point, and yet the majority of people in the general public have a very strong conviction that the supernatural is real. So it's this discrepancy between this common belief and the lack of evidence is something that I think we need to address. Why is this?
What is it about us as creatures in this cosmos, in your view then, that makes us so open and amenable to acceptance of the idea of supernatural? Even people you say who may, if you ask them formally, do you believe in science or the supernatural? They may say science, but when you look more closely, no, they've got some fuzzy area on that perhaps. Why? What is it about us the way, I don't know, is it our genes? Is it our upbringing? Is it something we hear in the womb?
I think it's our brains. My perspective is that the brain generates the mind, and the brain has been designed, if you like, through natural selection to seek out patterns in the world, to look for occurrences, to try and predict events in the world. And so we're naturally inclined to interpreting the world and seeing structure and order, and then trying to come up with some explanation about how those patterns have emerged. Now, very often some of those explanations are fine from a scientific perspective, but we often come up with explanations that, in fact, would be supernatural if they were true. So this is probably more familiar to your listeners in terms of superstitious rituals, you know, the lucky socks you have to wear on the day of the big game, or if you're in a job where, you know, the uncertainty of the outcome is really important, that you're a firefighter or a deep sea fisherman, you'll have rituals that you engage in because you want to appease, you know, you want to get all the luck.
Or a professional baseball player who stands at the plate tapping his arms and touching his ear every single time. Or you point out, in the UK, Tony Blair wore the very same shoes every time he had to take questions from Parliament. In the United States, John McCain with, what is it, he always carries a feather, what is it, a penny, a nickel, and a quarter or something?
Yeah, it was a quarter, a penny, a nickel, and a dime. So he had
always carries them.
31 super cents.
There you go. Or Barack Obama, who after played basketball the morning of his Iowa primary caucus victory, then decided always to play basketball on primary vote mornings.
Yeah.
Superstitious? Supernatural?
Yes, it is. Of course it is. I mean, there's no way that there's any causal relationship between these activities and the outcome. But here's the kicker. Because, in fact, by engaging in these rituals, people gain this sense of control. And this sense of control is very important because it inoculates you against the worst successes of uncertainty. We don't like uncertain outcomes. And so we have to engage in some behavior or some thought process which gives us this sense of control.
We have listeners who are interested in challenging you right now. Let's go to Lawrence, South Carolina, and John. John, you're on the air with Bruce Hood.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. It's actually Florence, South Carolina.
Excuse me. Thank you, John.
Yeah. Now, I was just going to comment that I agree with your speaker that it's all in the brain. The brain generates this pattern, and it's superstitious. It's connected to ignorance, too.
Are you then superstitious, John?
No, not at all.
Not in any dimension.
No, no. I mean, I think I, in the past, maybe have been guilty of, you know, I think it's, the way the brain works is, what do you got to lose by turning your hat sideways? Or what do you have to lose by tapping your shoes or have coins in your pocket? You have nothing to lose by doing that, and that plays into the superstition. That's how the mind justifies it.
John, let us do a little sort of live experiment here. Bruce Hood, here's John in Florence, South Carolina. In many ways, he's thinking right along your lines, but he says when it comes to himself, he is not superstitious, period.
Yeah. Hi there, John. Do you follow any sports teams?
Sports team? I've got my favorites, yeah.
Yeah, and do you have any kind of rituals that you like to do before you watch the game or... Is there any kind of little kind of habits or things that you feel more comfortable? You don't?
No.
Okay. What about, do you collect anything like memorabilia? Do you have any collections at all?
I enjoy collecting things that are old, you know, like old coins.
Do you get a sense of connection with the person who touched or owned it before? Do you like to have the original?
No, I don't think so. The fact that it's old and it survived, you know, it just, for me, it's something to collect.
Let me try one. John, if I may, this is out of Bruce's kind of repertoire, an Americanized version. You may remember, John, back in the very early 90s, the Jeffrey Dahmer case in Milwaukee took a dozen young men over time into his apartment, cut them up, put them in a vat, you know, abused them, tortured them, ate them, cannibalism. Would you, if you had his raincoat on, right in front of you, would you want to put it on?
No, I wouldn't want to put it on, but
why not? You know, it's just a raincoat.
It is. It's just, and maybe, you know, that's probably maybe some residual brain activity there. But if somebody challenged me to it, I could get past it.
You could get, but you'd rather not. John, you're a good sport to sort of go back and forth with these. but we take your point. In particular, I want you to come back, Bruce, to John says, look, it may be in our nature, but it's ignorance, he says.
Right. I think John is a perfect example of someone who's very rational and likes to rely on his analytical thinking. But interesting, that last example, most people hesitate. It's as if something kicks in very quickly. It's an odd question, admittedly, you know, to say, would you put on someone else's clothing?
A mass murderer's jacket, sweater, whatever. Yeah.
When I've done this, the way I usually do this demonstration in public is I offer, you know, $50, you know, if people will put on an old sweater or cardigan.
Of a killer.
But I don't tell them it's a killer.
Ooh.
So all the hands shoot up, and I'm sure, John, your hand would be right up
there
in the
not?
Air. But then I say, would you still wear it if it belonged to Jeffrey Dahmer? And most hands rapidly come down. You make this instant decision. It's as if your emotions are kicking walking in. And then people kind of come up with an explanation to justify why they've done this. Interestingly enough, there's always a couple of people in the audience, usually men, who will stand there with their hands up. But then the rest of the audience want to move away from them. So, you know, it's like this is like a taboo. And so there are many reasons why you probably wouldn't want to wear the sweater. But my point is that your initial response is almost intuitive and emotional. And of course, there's no kind of scientific or there's nothing in the cloth. But psychologically, we do have this tendency to what I call essentialism, the idea that the essence of someone evil could almost contaminate the physical world. And I think that's a very pervasive and very powerful intuition.
I want to come back to this question then of ignorance and how we understand that. Others, as you say, see it as being ahead of the curve, ahead of what science understands. But you kind of, I mean, I characterize it as you seeing pluses and minuses here. You don't entirely. We spend a lot of time talking, I don't know, about trying to banish superstition. But you're not entirely unsensitive to its utility.
Oh, absolutely. So if we just go back to the rituals that we talked about, I think they're very useful and very helpful for the individual when they're encountering stress. And so these rituals that we have, these superstitions, enable us to, you know, to take on difficult pastimes or jobs or, you know, even to play well. Here's the interesting thing. If you thwart somebody in their ritual, if you stop them wearing socks or you stop them doing their little tapping on the baseball ground, they don't perform as well because they feel they've lost the control. Their juju has been, you know, is being compromised.
Their mojo or
their
is,
mojo,
is
yeah,
off,
absolutely.
Right.
So that's at the individual level.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about why we believe the unbelievable with a neuroscientist who says it's scientifically driven. It's part of being human. Bruce Hood is with us. His new book is Super Sense, Why We Believe in the Unbelievable. Hugo is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Hugo. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bruce. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have a comment to make about superstition. I'm myself, I think I'm pretty superstitious. I'm not an extremely superstitious person, but I find that I observe certain things, like I look at numbers and I believe in astrology a bit, and I try to not let it, you know, control my life, but I admit that I do observe it. And I think that one thing that's interesting about superstition is just how it really opens our ability to see things differently, to accept greater possibilities. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that makes superstition helpful to the human race in some respect, where, you know, something that is not obvious can, an obvious solution is found from another super mean in some respect. And I think, it can even be applied to the belief in what would be considered secular. Science offers a lot of knowledge, and people sometimes just accept scientific fact without really looking at the evidence. And I think that that's, in a way, kind of a superstitious way of looking at it.
Interesting. So you're saying, in effect, that superstition can open up possibilities going forward, maybe even scientific possibilities or something beyond science as we understand it so far, anyway. It's a good perspective, Hugo. Thanks for bringing it. Bruce Hood, you're nodding along here. I mean, I still wonder.
Yeah.
The word ignorance came up from our earlier caller. Now, Hugo's open here. We spent many centuries, certainly in the scientific era, trying to banish ignorance.
Yeah.
And it's included superstition, that almost as, knee-jerk. But Hugo's open to it, says it may help us learn in some way, but keeping our minds open. Your response?
Yeah. Hi there, Hugo. I mean, you might be surprised. Actually, I do agree with some of the points you were making. I think that this issue of thinking superstitiously or supernatural is related to creative thinking is entirely true. And it's borne out by the experimental studies, which have shown that those people who are more inclined to relying on intuitive reasoning, this kind of sense of seeing patterns, are also more likely to endorse the possibility of the supernatural. And of course, science progresses not just by the slow, piecemeal, methodical, analytical process, but it does need those moments of insight, those moments of intuition, which seem to sort of shift us into a new realm of thinking. There are some classic cases, you know, people who dream of the structure of benzene or people who have insights into problems. I myself know that, you know, sometimes when I'm mulling over a problem, if I stop thinking about it for a bit and maybe go off and do something else, the idea will pop into my head. And I think that reflects the fact that a lot of our reasoning is going on unconsciously, and that's probably what I mean by this intuitive processes. So I think that, you know, rationality and analytical reasoning is very important, and it's part of the scientific method, but it also has to be seen in combination with a more kind of holistic process where you can process information and look for patterns.
You know, I'm open to that. I think a lot of people would be. On the other hand, I can't quite get past this. I mean, we put so much effort into trying to get, you know, sort of out of darkness of pre-science when everything was just, you know, mumbo-jumbo at one point because we didn't understand anything, you know, trying to get by that. It almost sounds like what you're saying there can sort of encourage, I don't know, does this turn us into, you know, quaking, twirling ninnies, afraid of our own shadows, kind of superstitious people?
No, and I also think that it's probably too simplistic to say that we either divide into those who are analytical scientists and those who are entirely spiritual. I mean, we have a combination. In psychology, we recognize there's at least two modes of thinking, this intuitive unconscious process and the secondary, you know, analytical scientific way of dealing with evidence. We're constantly fighting these intuitions, and I, you know, in the book, I deal a lot with child development and suggest that a lot of the origins of many adult supernatural beliefs can be traced to children, and these never entirely go away. And this is the, I suppose, the unique bit of the book is that these stay with us, and we're constantly fighting to suppress these ideas. But at times of stress or times where you get some kind of illness, you can see these naive ways of thinking reemerging.
I remember those very well. It took me how long to get to school, so I would never step on a crack and break my mother's back. Oh, my gosh. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I was obsessed, but a lot of kids have those little tics of superstition, natural.
Yeah. So this, let me tell you a little bit about some experimental work, which I think might intrigue you. We know that children spontaneously reason about the nature of the biological world. So they think about plants and trees, and they have a tendency to see these as being designed, and hence, you know, they're inclined towards a creationist kind of viewpoint.
Somebody must have built all
That's
this.
That's right.
Made this.
What could be more obvious? I mean, natural selection is actually counterintuitive to a lot of people. It's a very difficult concept to get their head around. Now, the thing is, this is the natural way of thinking. Now, with education, depending on which environment you're raised in, you could go towards a more kind of analytical scientific viewpoint. But if you take an adult and you put them in a task and you give them a really hard kind of computer task, so you're taxing their rational analytical brain.
To its limits, maybe.
To its limits. Mm-hmm. And then you ask them questions. You can see these seven-year-old answers popping back in again. It's almost as if it's the default. And also with patients with onset dementia like Alzheimer's, before they become really impaired, they too will answer questions about origins in a very kind of what we call a teleological stance. In other words, someone has made it like that. So this is almost
like...
In a
way, like, they regress to, the child's perspective.
Yeah. And in the same way is that when you're under a lot of stress, I think you can suddenly find your childhood kind of superstitions kicking in again.
Let's go to Holly in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hi, Holly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment about sort of the difference between thinking superstitiously and thinking symbolically. I was thinking about Jeffrey Dahmer's sweater or raincoat. And the reason that I wouldn't want to put it on would be not because I think that, you know, maybe his killer instinct would rub off on me, but because, especially in the way that you presented it and saying, this is Jeffrey Dahmer's sweater, it stands for something. It represents something. And I think that's actually a fairly advanced level of thinking. That's our brain's ability to be abstract.
But it... At the same time, certainly it stands for something, but scientifically, it's just a coat.
Sure, but I mean,
assuming it's been dry cleaned and, you know, cleansed thoroughly.
Sure, but isn't the brain's ability to think abstractly scientific? I mean, it's actually not something we're capable of doing when we're young. It's something that the brain learns to do as we get older and something we've learned to do as an advanced civilization. That's where our ability to create literature comes from.
Symbolic thinking, very important. What do you say, Bruce?
Well, absolutely, Holly. I think you've raised a very important criticism of a lot of these things I've been saying, which is this idea that some people think that there's an essence. Let me just tell you a little bit about another set of studies so I can...
Can you just ask before you do... You say essence, but something symbolic. It's different.
It is different.
Essence or a symbolic weight are quite different, aren't they?
They are quite different. I mean, another way people usually say the word is just association. So symbolism, association, that, you know, the sweater triggers mm-hmm. all the kind of symbolism of what it is to be a murderer. And that's certainly one of the explanations people use when they're justifying their response to the cardigan or sweater mm-hmm. example. And I think that's plausible. But I like also to bring to your attention this idea that when we think about the physical world, we often when it's an emotional object like a killer's cardigan, we think there's another property in addition to the physical one. And the way I'm going to show that this is true mm-hmm. is a very famous philosophical issue called the Ship of Theseus. Mm-hmm. The Ship of Theseus, was this Greek king, and they took a ship and it was a revered object and they put it in the museum. Mm-hmm. And each year they came back to it and they found that the planks were starting to rot away. So they would replace each plank eventually over the years.
Yeah.
And then the Roman historian Plutarch said, well, what happened to the original ship when all the planks of wood have gone mm-hmm. and you've replaced the ship? So there's no physical structure, no original material.
Is it
still the Ship of Theseus? Mm-hmm. And psychologically, we say, yes, it is. So there's something in addition to all the composite physical material aspects of an emotional object mm-hmm. that is irreplaceable. And if you put together all the other planks and you now have two ships, which is the original Ship of Theseus. So this is a psychological essentialism. There is, of course, no essence of the Ship of Theseus, but mm-hmm. psychologically, we feel that certain important, irreplaceable, special objects have something in addition to its material worth. So that's what I'm kind of getting at. It's this, I mean, and often people can't even articulate this way of thinking. Mm-hmm. It's just something that we feel is in the cloth or in the ring, that, you know, the wedding ring you don't want to exchange or, mm-hmm. you know, all the things which are irreplaceable, the original Vermeer, all these sorts of things are you know, have psychological essentialism.
Holly, you've taken us right to that good nuance. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Nick in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Well, what do you think, Nick?
Well, it's a fascinating topic. I was going to give you an early Christian perspective on all this stuff.
Yes, please.
There's a concept that exists in early Christianity called the nous, which is translated in English as the mind. But really what it basically is sort of a noetic, spiritual, internal, instinct. Maybe David Plouffe calls it an internal spiritual organ.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it's able to do is sort of have an instinctual understanding of that which is good and that which is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, they connected in Scripture to, demons and angels and the like, which are more manifestations, I think. But this idea of this sort of a spiritual instinct between what's good and bad would be, and whether you want to be connected to it in any way would be, you know, a good reason for the Jeffrey Dahmer aversion, mm-hmm. which I certainly would have.
Mm-hmm.
And also I was wondering what your perspective is on religion versus superstition. I know, for example, the guy who wrote Fall of the Roman, Edward Gibbons, I guess,
mm-hmm.
he said that the two were equated, you know, superstition and religion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nick, the great and big subjects. Let us pick that up. Thank you very much for calling, Bruce Hood. I mean, I approached this conversation with no small dread trepidation. Religious faith is not something I'm personally snide or dismissive mm-hmm, about, mm-hmm. far from it. And it's powerfully sustaining for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it comes right into your kind of framework here.
Yeah.
There's Nick's question. How do you see it?
Well, all religions have some supernatural component to it. Religions are narratives. They're culturally constructed, and they're based on existential questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? And where are we going? And we get our religion effectively from those around us, and this is how they propagate. But, of course, they work so well because they tie into many of our inclinations that there is something like a life after death. There has to be some origins. And they work very much to kind of provide a framework. They also provide a very good moral ground or a moral framework in which to conduct our lives.
But this super sense readiness from the womb that you describe predisposes humans.
Yeah, so work by my colleague Paul Bloom, and there's a number of other developmental psychologists, have been studying these various ideas about the spirit life, the notion of the afterlife, the theology I told you about earlier, mm-hmm. the fact that children see intelligent design everywhere. These are natural inclinations that you can trace, and we think they're occurring before we've had culture really indoctrinating children.
But we've had Richard Dawkins on this show, famous British scientific critic of religion, fierce critic of religion.
Indeed,
so
yeah.
Let's get to science. Let's leave this behind. We've had Daniel Denton, the philosopher, on here, also very critical of religion. They want to put it in a supernatural box and throw it overboard.
That's right. Well, Denton, of course, talks about the supers and the brights, dividing humans into one versus the other. I think that's too simplistic. I think within individuals you can find both modes of thinking operating. And both Richard Dawkins and understand, and it, of course, talk about memes. These are these ideas which propagate through a population, the beliefs that are almost like mental viruses. I have a problem with meme theory, because I don't think we're blank slates for any old idea. I think that we have inclinations to accept some ideas and not others. And whilst the testimony of the parents and our spouses are very important, it has to be seen as an interaction between an inclination and what the information we're told. Because how else could we explain why identical twins raised in the same in the same household could have varying opinions? Or, you know, for example, Christopher Hitchens is a very anti-religious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but his brother is a very strong Christian. So we.
But wait, when you say you don't follow the meme dismissal here, does that mean, what are you saying by that? That it's not supernatural? I mean, it is supernatural by definition.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I'm not challenging the. No, I'm an atheist. I don't believe there's any evidence for the gods and the spirits and so forth. What I'm saying is that I think the mode of transmission about mm-hmm. why we have such strong beliefs mm-hmm. in culture is not entirely down to indoctrination. That's the issue. Let's imagine a thought experiment. If you took a bunch of kids and you did the Lord of the Flies scenario and you raise them in an island and there's mm-hmm. there's no culture around them, I would predict strongly that they would, by themselves, come up with their own rituals, their own little practices, and in effect generate their own religion. And certainly what you find when you look around the origins of civilization, we've got the evidence that right back in prehistory, 60,000 years ago, we got these objects, these artifacts were clearly used in rituals. So mm-hmm. it's been there from the very beginning. But also you find looking in cultures who are very diverse in different areas around the world, mm-hmm. a lot of very shared belief systems, which strongly suggests that these have a common natural emergence. Now, Richard Dawkins has actually said that, and so has Dan Dennett in the book. Mm-hmm. But they think the evidence, and you know, this is an interesting empirical question that mm-hmm. we need to sort out. They believe that the evidence strongly indicates that it's the testimony and the indoctrination of children which is causing these things to propagate.
Not only that, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, they push back against religion. Mm-hmm. I don't read you as quite as antagonistic. You see a kind of community good, even if,
yeah.
I mean, you call yourself an atheist, and nevertheless conceding a kind of community good? Do I read you correctly?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is the other contribution of the book in many ways. It's the way that these belief systems can actually coalesce a group of individuals into a social community. It was pointed out to me that when you have groups of people that come together with a common consensus, they have to agree there are certain values in their society which cannot be owned by any one individual. So even the richest businessman or the poorest beggar on the street have got to recognize there are certain sacred values.
The holy thing or belief. Or...
It could be the temple, it could be the mm-hmm. book, it could be the tree or the rock. But these are just not natural. These are not simple, mundane things. These are profound objects, sacred objects.
Why?
Well, because if you buy into this, because it's there's no evidence for it, you just have to take it on faith mm-hmm. that this is something which is special and unique. Having a super sense that this is possible, you know, these things could be almost transcendent, is something that everyone agrees to. So that someone who doesn't buy into that belief system, you can ostracize them because they don't share the same sacred values that you do. So when we go and invade a country and we smash down their temples, you know, that's sacrilegious because we've violated that society's sacred values. And whereas we have our own sacred values in our own society.
It's I'm not sure that comes across instantly as good, though I do understand its utility in rallying around this symbol or that, this religion or that. It certainly may have been a survival advantage.
Okay.
Good in those evolutionary terms and maybe much more. Bruce Hood is with us. His new book is Super Sense, Why We Believe in the Unbelievable. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about why we believe the unbelievable with a neuroscientist who says it's scientifically driven. It's part of being human. Bruce Hood is my guest. He's chair of developmental psychology, director of the Cognitive Development Center at the University of Bristol in southwest England. He's out with a new book, Super Sense, Why We Believe in the Unbelievable. Let's take a call from Clarendon, Vermont, and Jamie. Hi, Jamie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. The scientific revolution kind of brought in a change of paradigm on how we, view the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read Shakespeare, you see that he has potions, ghosts, witches, and spells. And I was wondering if your guest could just kind of comment on whether he thinks that the bard was talking about something that people actually perceived, or he was just, you know, writing for to make it more interesting, you know, because does he think that people actually perceive the supernatural and it was part of their experience, and that's why Shakespeare...
Jimmy, are you suggesting in that question that maybe that we, humans were more in the grip of superstition, let's say in Shakespeare's day, that there's an evolution out away?
Yeah, because before the Scientific Revolution, when everything was explained more empirical. And
that's wonderful.
He always writes about spells and potions and that sort of thing. And I wondered if the guests thought that it was something that was perceived by the normal individual, or it was just something that was the way that we look at it now is something that's make-believe.
A great question. Yeah. Look back to Shakespeare and Caliban and all the rest. Before that science, were we really living in just a... Well, you hear Jimmy's
question. Thanks, Jimmy, for that question. I mean, in the pre-scientific era, to not believe in the magic at the time was considered irrational because that was the dominant mode of thinking at the time. Of course, with science and the scientific revolution, we've had an exponential rise in our understanding of the complexity of the universe. Science has been extraordinarily powerful in generating technologies. But there hasn't really been, I don't think, a corresponding increase or decline in the tendency to think that there might be something else to be explained. We have a new word now. We call it paranormal rather than magical. Mm-hmm. But they're effectively the same ideas, that there are hidden forces and things operating. I think Shakespeare was just holding up a mirror to the time, as we do today. If you turn on the television or you look at any of the bestsellers or any blockbuster films, they've all got aspects of the supernatural. And that's because this is something that people find absolutely fascinating. It's not just the fantasy of the possibility of imagination. For a lot of people, they really think there's something to be explained. And I should just point out, people who are inclined towards the paranormal don't really necessarily regard it as supernatural. They just think that science is slow in catching up and recognizing that there's phenomena out there that need explanation.
Let me get you on the record on that then, on the paranormal. Do you see it as sort of pre-envisioning the future, feeling it somehow before science confirms it, that science will one day catch up, or do you see it as just make-believe, period?
Well, let me confess here. When I first thought about going to university, I watched Uri Geller on television, like, you know, thousands and millions of other people around. I was convinced that there's something that needed to be explained. It was so compelling seeing Uri Geller bending spoons and doing... He was the guy who could do the precognition stuff and make objects and watches start and stop. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. So I went to university and took science and then discovered actually, you know, the majority of conventional scientists have rejected this as trickery. Mm-hmm. And the more that I kind of looked into it, I realized that probably there was no substantiated evidence for the paranormal. So it's been a big disappointment. On the other hand, kind of researching consciousness and the emergence of the mind and belief systems has been, you know, equally exciting.
But jumping off then of Jamie's question about the past, I mean, if you look to the future, we've had a big age of science.
Yeah.
It's had huge benefits. It's also had big problems. We've had nuclear war, at least nuclear bombs. Mm. I mean, here's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org, and Christine says, I wonder if we're moving sort of post-scientific in a way.
Yeah.
She says to you, I wonder why you believe that living intuitively versus rationally is somehow inferior. I, she says, make most of my decisions on instinct and strong feelings, which usually turns out to make sense.
Well, I apologize if I've come over with that impression, because hopefully I've tried to flag up that we all have both modes of thinking. And yes, actually, scientifically, women are more inclined towards the intuitive processes, and under time constraints, men do tend towards the analytical kind of way of thinking. But we've got both types of thinking within all of us.
Is intuition superstition?
No, it's not superstition at all. Intuition is just unconscious thinking. But that unconscious thinking can sometimes lead to explanations which would be supernatural. That's the point.
Is intuition supersense, to your word?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, we've got intuitions which reflect our expertise. So, for example, you might be, I don't know, you might be someone who evaluates works of art or can weigh up a car. Mm-hmm. You know, you can make...
And you've quickly done a calculus on the basis of world experience.
World experience leads you to make these very quick judgments, and then you have a feels right kind of notion. So you know emotionally, deep down, you know you're right. That's what I mean by an intuition.
Well, then super sense is unrelated to factual basis? Is fictional?
If you believe that there are certain forces operating in the world, you know, you can tell when you're being watched from behind, you might get a gut feeling that you're being watched. That's your intuition. You turn around and, oh my gosh, you are being watched. And therefore, you've reinforced your worldview. But if I put you in a laboratory and trying to measure that capability over beyond chance, then it doesn't really exist. But your intuition is it's really there.
Let's take a call from Max in Hull, Massachusetts. Hi, Max. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an English teacher, and we're reading Huckleberry Finn.
Great.
And we're just having this conversation yesterday, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
about superstition as a form of cultural currency between Tom, between Huck Finn and Jim. And I'm interested in it more from that cultural aspect.
Give us a sense of what you mean by superstition as a cultural currency between Huck and Jim on the river.
Yeah, well, it's clear that, you know, that Huck Finn doesn't have access or doesn't have value in the religious training that he's been given. And I think he values, like, superstitions and good luck and bad luck in the same way that, you know, that we value our college degrees.
Mm. And the currency is what? In conversation, he's kind of one-upping Jim on who's got the stronger juju going on or what?
Well, it's more like I know how to access good luck, mm-hmm. and you know, and I have a certain number of superstitions that it actually defers to Jim's expertise. Jim is definitely more of an expert on this occult knowledge. You know, how to maintain good luck, how to avoid bad luck.
It's great. Max, you've got us jumping from Shakespeare to Mark Twain on the river, and Bruce Hood's nodding along. Bruce?
Yeah, well, Chesterton said that if you take away God, it's not that man doesn't believe in anything. He'll just believe in, you know, he doesn't stop believing in God. He just believes in anything. And this is an interesting point, that in today's modern era, there seems to be a shift away from conventional religion to more secular notions of the spiritual. So the paranormal and the ESP and the New Age thinking is something which seems to be growing in strength. In fact, there was a document published last week by the papacy and Rome, and they're concerned. Mm-hmm. Last week that we heard that Reiki, you know, this New Age Japanese where you can channel energies and flow, it's a New Age therapy.
Okay.
The church has banned it in the U.S., the Catholic Church.
Banned?
Yeah, they don't want
do
it.
Do not mess around with this stuff.
Do not touch. You know, they're concerned, and their rationality or the reason for it was the concern that there might be malevolent spirits and so forth. So I think the church, in certainly from the Catholic perspective, are worried about this emergence of these alternative kind of viewpoints of the world. So I think that this sounds a little bit like the story you're referring to, that some people might reject religion but then seek out some other kind of avenue to express their spiritual, supernatural belief.
Let's push this on maybe even a bit outside of what you look at in the book, but we've just come through this period we're now fallen out of economic bubble and boom and people believing in a kind of endless prosperity or always up, and not just believing it, but putting their cash, lots of it in there. I mean, what about in the economic realm, the political realm? Do you see counterparts there, ways in which sort of magical thinking or super sense go to work wholly outside the paranormal or, you know, black cats?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said earlier on, that we don't like uncertainty. And what could be worse than economic uncertainty? And there's been experimental work that when you induce uncertainty in people in these computer tasks, they start to become more ritualistic and they start to endorse more supernatural beliefs. The studies of previous depressions have shown that there's
economic depressions
mm-hmm. have shown that there's an increase in this kind of superstitious, supernatural belief systems.
But what about before the depression or whatever it is, before the crash? I mean, do you look back on that and say, well, that's a kind of supernatural belief as well, when everybody was all lathered up and ready to, you know, go play Wall Street forever?
Well, I mean, of course, I'm not a trader, but I can imagine that there can be a riding the crest of the wave when everyone else is buying into it, and you get this escalation of bidding on effectively it's gambling. Then it's probably not too surprising. There's a herd mentality where people will start to put money where they really, you know, the reason's gone out the window, in the sense that the group consensus is that the mark is bullish. And so you do get this kind of irrational behavior.
And where are the more ticks of superstition than literally in a gambling casino? I can't think of anywhere else where people are doing more kind of, you know, little touch this or have your lucky rabbit's foot and all the rest.
Yeah, and it's an attempt to kind of control what are uncontrollable outcomes in many ways.
Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Good. I wonder if Bruce Hood would consider whether, in fact, he's got this backwards, and that we aren't programmed for irrationality, but we're rather relentlessly programmed for rationality. Tom, you mentioned that our ancestors lived in a time of mumbo jumbo, and it's convenient to kind of dismiss that as a know-nothing period. But the reality is that what those people were able to do was survive in a very hostile environment, and they did it by replicating survival strategies that they may not have understood, but that they knew worked.
Absolutely. Well, they felt worked.
We are here, So they
yes.
survived, so they worked.
Yep.
And my point is that what has changed in a very blink of an eye, 50,000 years mm-hmm. of human history is a very brief period. What has changed is a miraculous explosion in our understanding of the connections of things. So our history is that we've always abandoned things that were no longer useful. If that weren't the case, the survival strategies we use today, we would never have learned. All the way from sailing west to get east to steering in the direction of a skid. These are all things that intuitively make no sense, but we have learned, and we adjust our daily lives accordingly. So I think you're kind of shortchanging the triumph of the rational over the ignorant in human history.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. We've spoken about the utility, and I guess you're saluting the utility, even of things that may not be scientifically verifiable, Mark. And I say mumbo-jumbo, but that doesn't mean, you know, I agree with you. That's a kind of moment in history looking back. I mean, certainly, Lord knows, I've got snake handlers in the family. And yes, we're here today. But this comes back, and thank you, Mark, this comes back, Bruce, to the way in which you at least nod toward these as having their benefits.
Yeah, I don't think actually I'm disagreeing with Mark at all. I don't think it's exactly this strategy. Where do these strategies come from? They clearly are adaptive, and that's why they're still around. And you know, I talked about the individual value of ritual, but then there's ritual for the group as well. And mm-hmm. we had some discussion mm-hmm. about how that could work to coalesce people.
But on balance, do you see these rituals? Maybe they're survival tactics in a way. Mark looks that direction.
Yeah.
Do you see them as, on balance, a positive or, and again, I'm just picking up on, I say mumbo jumbo. Well, you know, we've got a lot of cultural training that trains us to look backward and put that label there. Do you see these as a drag on, I don't know, the full blossoming of human potential or an aid?
Oh, they're definitely an aid. I don't see they're a drag. And I think the word irrational is, unfortunately, has such bad connotations. It's almost as if it's woolly thinking. Clearly, these are adaptive, and that's why this is Mark's point, that they're still around. And
but
so,
Lord knows there's been a lot of irrationality that's had huge costs. People burned at the stake and, you know, people have suffered enormously.
Ah, well, this is where...
Because they were a witch.
Yeah, but this is where beliefs are used as a political agenda to subjugate other people. These are now issues of... I agree, beliefs do motivate people to do things, but very often the kind of subjugation or the crusades are driven by economic agendas as well.
Well, but it's awfully... I mean, it seems too easy to just unhitch those sitting here today when people suffered through the reality of
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that though beliefs, again, gets back to this idea, if we have the shared beliefs as our social group, we can use this as a justification to kind of engage in all sorts of manners of atrocities against others.
Let's get a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. And Tom, hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
A couple of questions for your guest, Dr. Hood. Looking over your book, I was struck by the fact that one supernatural belief you talk about is belief in free will. So two questions come up. Could you say why you think belief in free will is supernatural or is an illusion?
Mm.
The second question is, do you think we should believe in free will even if we don't have it?
Oh, wow. That's a real hard set of questions. Yeah,
good.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom.
You got me there, Tom. Okay, free will. This is that's a book in itself, I should point out. But yes, we all have this experience that when we make decisions, we're doing it on the basis of reason, that we're in advance of our behavior, that we're deciding to do things, and that our rationale process of arriving at decisions is one on balance of the evidence. But actually, a lot of the processes which feed into our decision-making are unconscious. There's a lot of biases which are operating. So although we may think we actually have free will, very often there are other mechanisms which are operating, which are almost steering us towards decisions. There's some experimental work I talk about in the book which strongly suggests that many aspects of conscious control are an illusion. The one I like is Liebert's experiment, where you get people to kind of press a button when they feel they really want to do it. But in fact, you measure their brain activity and they're already moving the button before they're consciously aware they've made the decision. So that shows that in that kind of situation, that kind of free will of making a choice is actually something after the event. My colleague Steve Pinker has often made this point.
At Harvard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, consciousness is the spin doctor of experience. In a sense, it's almost like the dialogue we use to justify actions after they've already happened. And again, it's this idea that a lot of the processes which feed into our decision-making are unconscious.
It's a book in itself. Tom, we won't get to all of it. Let me just ask you this, Bruce, our Dr. Hood, our time is dwindling down. If you were all-powerful, if you could set the needle, would you make human behavior more rational, less? Do you think we've got the right balance?
I think the balance is inevitable. As again, it's because it's almost a biological.
It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Doesn't unchanging over time, even as science,
it changes,
makes its noise?
It changes its manifestation. Okay, before it was spirits in the woods and goblins and elves. They now are in the realm of fantasy, but now we have poltergeists, and we're changing almost. We're updating our belief systems to kind of fit with the changing technology. And I still don't think it's ever going to go away. I love this story, by the way, of Charles Simonyi, who is the co-founder of Microsoft. He's just completed, I think, or he may still be orbiting the Earth as we speak. But he flew up in the Russian rocket,
paid a zillion bucks, and up he went twice, yeah. Second time or third now.
That is the pinnacle of human achievement in technology and science,
yes.
Isn't it? Building rockets,
mm-hmm.
And yet they still had to do the superstitious ritual of relieving themselves on the back wheels of the bus on the way to the launch pad.
Human beings to the end, even in orbit.
Indeed.
Wow. Bruce Hood's new book is Super Sense, Why We Believe in the Unbelievable. Bruce, Dr. Hood, it's been wonderful speaking with you. Thank you very much for being here today.
It's been great, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.